May it please the court, my name is Ed Gill. I represent Ryan Frisager, who is the defendant appellant in this case. In October of 2008, two children appeared before the family court in Sussex County. They were in state custody and were foster care at that time. They were told by the family court judge, who they were before that day, that their sister, perhaps they could not come to live with them because perhaps this was in fact had a parent. Was able to go and care for that half-sister. Unfortunately, that parent was William Frisager, and that afternoon, after they were told they could not live with their sister, they went to school, and Tiffany Sierra reported and claimed at that time that for an extended period of time, for when she was 6 to 10 years old, and later her sister claimed for a period of time when she was 8 to 13 years old, that William Frisager had sexually abused her. That started this entire process moving forward with these allegations. The allegations were horrific, numerous, repeated. They claimed that Mr. Frisager sexually abused them in various ways while they were awake, while they were asleep, that they were routinely raped and apparently didn't know it. With other people in the room, they were going to multi-trauma counseling at the time for problems that they had with their mother, and told the multi-trauma counselor that no such sexual abuse had occurred. They had a DFS worker who they were close with and told them, that DFS worker, that no sexual abuse occurred. Had a mentor counselor at school who they were close to report no sexual abuse during this long time period when they claimed that the sexual abuse was occurring. When this matter came for trial in June of 2009, and throughout the process, there was absolutely zero corroboration. No forensic evidence, no physical evidence, no witnesses even to back up that they'd seen these things currently, or prior to or aftermath of these horrific events occurring. The allegations were denied by Mr. Frisager consistently. He testified in his trial. He denied that any sexual abuse occurred whatsoever. And I give the court this somewhat detailed background as to what this case presented to point out that this was as close a case as can possibly be imagined, because in the state's answering brief in response to many legal allegations that have been made, the state claims this was not a close case. And we expect to say otherwise, that this was certainly, under any reasonable interpretation of that phrase, a very close case. This case was presided over by a judge whose own sister-in-law had been raped. His own sister-in-law had been raped by one of the same people who had raped one of the complaining children in the case of Barr. This case had the same chief investigating officer, Detective Conaway of the Delaware State Police, as in the trial judge's sister-in-law's.
When did the trial judge become aware of this?
To my knowledge, when I prior to the trial, when I brought the issue up in the motion for recusal.
Was that on the day of trial, or was that done how many days before trial?
It was done on the day of trial, Your Honor. The reason I did not know that, and the way it came about, as I pointed out in the record when I made the motion, obviously a lot of downtime in the trial process. Senator Conaway, I had known for many years, I had quite a few cases, were sitting there at the table, was basically reminiscing and pointed out that he had been the chief investigating officer at the time, but he told me about his sister's rape case. And that's, I obviously pointed this out to my client the next chance I got. We made the motion for recusal. What I did not know until even after the trial, was that the person, Marvin Dallas, who had raped the trial judge's sister-in-law, is one of the same people who one of the complaining children in this case claims, and they certainly have no reason to doubt that allegation, claims raped one of the children prior to that child having contact with Mr. Fritzen. So that, and the question is, I guess one of the questions is, subjectively, did the trial judge, I didn't know that throughout the entire process, as the court can review the colloquy that was placed in the appendix. I obviously didn't bring that up because I didn't know about it. But certainly the chief investigating officer knew that. This was within the knowledge of the state throughout that time period. And whether the judge actually knew that in her mind at the time, obviously I have no knowledge regarding that, but as juries are instructed, what you need to do is take a look at all the evidence and make reasonable conclusions.
Well, perhaps you misunderstood my question or I misunderstood your answer. My question was, when did the trial judge know of this apparent personal involvement with one of the witnesses' past acts? I don't know a better way to phrase it. There probably is. And you thought, I thought you said to me, when you filed your motion for recusal before the trial began. Is that wrong?
No, and I apologize if I was not clear on that.
Well, I may have misunderstood.
Clear in my response to that, or Justice Bridges' question, also in addition. I didn't file a motion, Your Honor. I did not file a written motion asking for recusal. I don't know how the trial judge would have known until she actually came there to trial and started figuring out who the witnesses were, who was involved in the case. So I think all the evidence leads us to believe that right before the trial, when I orally made the motion for recusal, is what I think the evidence indicates is the first time that the trial judge knew that there was this problem. Immediately prior to trial, based on my oral motion.
And based on in your oral motion asked the trial judge to do what?
To recuse herself.
Why?
Because her sister-in-law had been the victim of a rape. And in that case, trial judge also was the attorney general of the state of Delaware, she pointed out, and has some involvement. Marginal, as she had characterized it in the prosecution of that case. But the trial judge's sister-in-law being raped, and in that rape case, the same chief investigating officer, who was the same chief as was in the case at bar, who obviously sat at the prosecution table, was an integral part of the prosecution team, testified for the prosecution in Mr. Fritzinger's case.
But at that point, neither you nor the trial judge knew that there was any link to a complaining witness in the trial that was about to begin, correct?
I can speak for myself, Your Honor, but here's what the trial judge had by that point. The trial judge obviously had contact with that prior case and would have known who the assailant was. The defendant was in that prior case. It turns out to be a man by the name of Marvin Dallas. The trial judge, by that point in time, had also listened to a CAC tape of one of the complaining witnesses in this case, Melissa Sierra, in which she detailed the Sierra, the child in this case, detailed the sexual abuse. She specified what the sexual abuse was by Marvin.
And when you say Marvin, you say that with emphasis as if no last name was in the tape?
I don't know the answer to that. I still, as I stand here today, have not listened to that tape because the trial judge's ruling at that time was that defense is not even allowed to listen to the tape, and obviously that's one of the legal issues which I presented here on this appeal, that not only should I have had the opportunity to listen to the tape, videotape, watch the tape, but that the evidence was crucial as far as being introduced to the jury in this case. And what the jury
I understand. That's a different issue. What I'm concerned about is what evidence is there that suggests that the trial judge who presided over this trial and made all the rulings that you're going to tell us about that you believe are adverse to your client knew before the trial began that there was a personal link between her life and the life of one of the complaining witnesses.
Inferences. Your Honor, I obviously, as I said before, I'm not in the trial judge's head, but the trial judge was the Attorney General of the state of Delaware at the time of the sister-in-law prosecution. She has some direct personal the trial judge involved in that case, discussing the case, actually, with her sister-in-law at the time about her sister-in-law's cooperation. Again, according to what the trial judge put on the record in this case. And the trial judge knew, obviously, the trial judge had listened to this and watched this videotape, which, again, as I stand here today, I still don't know any specifics other than what the court reported is on there about Marvin. Now, we don't believe that Marvin was a stranger to Melissa Sierra, so it wasn't that some man jumped in my window, who I don't know. We believe it was a babysitter relationship, so she would have actually been able to know who the person was. And I find it very difficult to believe that a trained CAC investigator who was asking this child, tell me about what occurred at this prior sexual abuse, would not simply ask the name of the person. It is possible that the child didn't tell me. It's possible the child gave a false name. I don't know.
I'm going to give you time to get to the other issues. But as far as you knew at the time you made your motion to recuse, you didn't know, and the record didn't reflect that there was any personal relationship between the trial judge and the complaining witnesses. Past history of sexual abuse.
Correct.
Okay.
But the state certainly had that knowledge. There's no doubt the state had that knowledge.
Okay.
Because the chief investigator was the same. And as Your Honor led to, we ended up with ruling in this case in which the trial judge referred to the children's victims to the jury at the very close of the case after all the evidence had been submitted. All the arguments, for the most part, have been made by counsel. And actually, made a comment, you can find it on page 197 of the appendix, when sustaining an objection to Tiffany Sierra's testimony by the defense side, she made a comment directly to Tiffany Sierra in the presence of the jury. Well, there are some things that you know which we're in court, you simply can't say those in front of the jury. Leading the jury to believe that there were other things that were in the knowledge of this witness, or maybe any other witness for that matter, that the jury was being kept from hearing. The errors we have set forth in the briefs, the opening and rebuttal briefs, the state accurately points out is that we urge this court in these type of cases regarding other sexual contact or other sexual conduct of a complaining witness to adopt a Pulisano type test, Wisconsin Supreme Court test, in determining admissibility. And what we ended up with in this case is children. And children is what the state called them in closing argument. Children is what the judge told the jury was a fact in this case, referring to these complaining witnesses. Children talking about specific and detailed sexual acts. And the jury was left, as a result of that, with a completely false impression that the only source of these children's knowledge would have been the defendant, Mr. Fritzen. If we do a Pulisano type analysis, one, five steps, we know that the prior acts occurred, there's no dispute about that. It's the same type, again, on page A102, the trial judge, and I still have not watched the tape as I stand here today, tells us that there was oral sex involved, and that seems to be what most of the great detail came about, oral sex involved on this Melissa Sierra tape. And also, of course, there was penile vaginal sex with the foster boyfriend, which caused a concern about the pregnancy. It's relevant to the issues, the knowledge of how these children will be able to tell these things. It's necessary. It's the only way the defense can go ahead and bring these things up. And there's really no, when you talk about probative versus prejudice, there's really no prejudicial value or no prejudicial effect to the state. Could have even been possible if the tape was detailed enough that the tape itself, without even asking any questions, may have been enough to be introduced to the jury to show these other sexual contact, but the judge didn't even let us get to those things.
There's been, across the country, state Supreme Courts and other courts have addressed the application of the rape shield statute to this type of proffered evidence, and there's a ALR fourth annotation, compiling those cases. But you're suggesting that the rule we should adopt is Wisconsin's rule?
It's Wisconsin's, and it's also, as I think the state accurately points out in their brief, it's the same as New Jersey. It's the same as Connecticut. I don't believe that it's any different, really, but in my research, the Wisconsin court, I think, laid it out in that five-step analysis, really gives us, and should give this court the best handle. Yes, I am urging this court to adopt that particular rule.
To the extent that other states have not, you would tell us not to follow their lead.
Yes, there's implications of confrontation clause, obviously in this case under both the Delaware and United States constitutions, and most importantly, due process of justice when the jury is left with a completely false impression as to what the evidence is. The rape shield law, there's no allegation that we're trying to use this to claim that somehow these girls consent. Obviously, there's no allegation of that whatsoever. And that's the main purpose of why we have rape shield laws. This isn't to harass, this is for a completely relevant purpose. By the time we're running brief, the only other point I did want to go back to how did it impact the process with the trial judge having these issues. And I would respectfully submit in two separate ways. One, sympathy and empathy is when one's family member, when one's sister-in-law is raped and a child on the witness stand, who I would think any reasonable or human being person is going to invoke some type of sympathy and empathy, but that brings in the personal knowledge, that brings in the personal
Well, didn't the trial judge expressly address that concern and say that what happened to her former sister-in-law did not influence her in any way?
No, because she never brought that up. As I said before, I never knew that until after sentencing in this case. And the second way would be reliability, because the trial judge knew that when her sister-in-law, or at least her mind, when her sister-in-law made this allegation, and that person was convicted as I put into the appendix, that Marvin Dallas was in fact a rapist. And so it adds credibility and reliability to this child's allegations against Mr. Fritzer when she's making the same allegations as in the case of Barr. Under 30 seconds, and unless the court has any additional questions for me this time, I'll
say okay.
Justice Ridgely asked first. The judge specifically discussed, one, the fact that the chief investigating officer was the same in her former sister-in-law's case, a person that obviously she had a relationship with one time and enough of a relationship that when that person did not want to, was concerned about the same circumstances in her own rape case, had talked to her, that's what was on the record. But the judge looked at it and said, no, I don't think I have a problem here at all. The fact that there's a chief investigating officer involved in that case who's the same in this case doesn't affect me at all. As to the Marvin situation, the problem is that Mr. Gill still says, well, it's obviously the same guy. There's no evidence of that, and there's no evidence that the judge would have known that it would have been perhaps even the same person. When we get to the end of it, though, the matter is, it doesn't much matter. There is nothing in relation to these two separate crimes that would have given reason for a judge, for one to even question that a judge could be impartial there. What we are talking about. Now, if Marvin had been the person seated next to Mr. Gill at the table, yeah, that would have been a problem, obviously. If someone could see the connection there that obviously a judge who's at least even former family member had been victimized by him, that judge probably shouldn't sit on his own trial. But to say that this young lady had said that she may have been molested by someone prior to this by the name of Marvin, and that that may have been somebody who also sexually abused the judge's former sister-in-law later on, there's simply no connection.
Why do you say may have been?
May have been
molested by Marvin Dallas.
Well, they...
She either was or wasn't.
And we don't know. It's interesting that Mr. Gill, during the trial, says, I want to put this in. His argument was always, I want this tape because I want to be able to cross-examine this girl on what's in that tape. And in fact, time and again, the trial judge said, there are things in there that I might be able to pull out for cross-examination. And in fact, his claim was, those allegations involving prior sexual abuse were false. I want to use that evidence to show that she's made false sexual allegations before to, quote, manipulate the process.
Yeah, I understand. There are two different issues here, at least in my mind. The first issue that I'm still not clear about is, did the state have reason to believe that a child complaining witness in this case had been sexually molested by the same person that had raped the trial judge's sister? Did the state have reason to believe that that link existed before the trial began?
No. I talked to Ms. Adams, who actually had done the briefing, and we contacted the trial prosecutor again today, and just said, where did Mr. Gill get this link from? And
well, the state includes the chief investigating officer. Did he know?
I do not know. I can't answer that question. I don't know. Honestly, I have never listened to that second tape. I don't know if there's a last name used or if there's some identifying information in there that would say, by the way, this happens to be the same.
Is it correct that the trial judge saw the tape?
And
yes. The trial judge would have known whether or not the person that the complaining witness or the child complaining witness said sexually molested her was the same name as the person that had raped her sister.
I don't know if it was Marvin only in the tape.
I know you don't know, but my point is it correct that the trial judge saw the videotape?
Yes.
And would have known whether it was simply Marvin or Marvin Dallas?
I assume.
And that occurred before trial?
That occurred the second day of trial. I believe it was right before the actual trial proceedings started, because Detective Conway showed up for the...
the trial judge would have seen the videotape before she made several rulings that are in dispute on this appeal, correct?
Certainly.
And the trial judge knew that the chief investigating officer in this case was the same as the chief investigating officer in her sister-in-law's rape case. She definitely knew that.
Yes, that had been pointed out. That was the basis for the motion for recusal. Whether or not there was anything in that second tape that looked enough that she had knowledge that there was any other tie, I cannot tell you.
We just don't know.
No, we do not know. Certainly one would assume that if there was enough information, as this issue had already been raised by Mr. Gill before, about the the sister-in-law's prior case, that the judge would have said, that's not the only link. You know, that's there. If there was enough information to tie those two things together in that second tape. But in the end, the question is that circumstance so damaging, so disqualifying, that one would have to say, this is a judge, either subjectively, and we know what the answer is subjectively, because one is certainly to the CIO, she specifically said, that's not an issue at all. And my former sister-in-law's circumstance isn't an issue at all to me. But objectively, can someone look at it and say, well, that judge just, that's a judge where we have to question the reliability of any decision she makes because of this rather tenuous type of link. Again, if Marvin had been sitting in that chair, I think the answer clearly would be yes. That trial judge should not be sitting on a case of someone who victimized even a former member of her family. I think people would question that circumstance. In this circumstance, the answer is no. In fact, if anything, she would have out probably more for Marvin than for Mr. Fritzinger. And probably it would inure to Mr. Fritzinger's benefit if she believed that.
What if Marvin was a witness in the case?
If Marvin was a witness in the case, it could be a problem. It would depend. It's always fact-sensitive when you try to determine whether or not refusal is appropriate, and depending on what the facts were.
Well, isn't, given the nature of the raised issues of error, isn't the real focus on whether or not the knowledge, if it existed on the part of the trial judge, of the link between Marvin Dallas, her sister-in-law, and the complaining witness in this case, whether or not that would cause one to perceive that the trial judge would have generated within her such sympathy for the complaining witness that it would affect the way in which she would be protective of them or rule in the case, not so much a focus on having any animosity toward Mr. Fritzinger, but whether or not it engendered an unnatural, unusual, avoidable perception of sympathy for the complaining witnesses.
That could be a concern. That certainly could
why
be.
It, explain to me why it isn't or shouldn't be a concern.
I don't think I've suggested it shouldn't be a concern because the judge made it very clear whenever she was asked about, at least when the recusal aspect of it was, and by then she had already seen the tape because they had already asked for the evidence in light of the 3508 motion. When the judge went to discuss her specific subjective belief of impartiality in this case from all of the circumstances of her sister-in-law, and let's assume she has in her head then, well, one of those circumstances is that this is the same assailant. The prior assailant of this victim was an assailant of my former sister-in-law. At that point, when the judge is specifically asked, what is my subjective belief here, she indicates that she has no issue arising from the situation with her former sister-in-law. And I suggest, and I believe Your Honor's question went more to the objective standard of that, that objectively, there's also no real reason to believe that she's going to have some greatly engendered sympathy for the child victim in this case, any more than any adult judge would have for any young person in that circumstance. That relationship really doesn't add anything to a greater level of sympathy for the victim.
Well, would you agree that a victim is not a victim until the jury concludes that a defendant is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and until that verdict comes back, the person who testifies that they have been victimized should be referred to by the neutral magistrate presiding as a complaining witness and not saying in front of the fact finder that this witness is not simply complaining that she's a victim. She is, in the view of the judge, a victim. Is that problematic?
Is it a better practice? Yes. But is it a word of art that we use constantly during trials and throughout history? It is. There's no doubt about that.
Well, it may be a word that we use in terms of the trial attorneys or the investigating police officers. My question is, knowing the perceived impact that the neutral magistrate has on a fact-finding jury, is it a word that the judge should use?
When there is a question as to whether or not the offense occurred itself or whether or not there is consent, this court has said no. The problem is, however, even our jury instructions use the term victim in certain portions. So it is one that would be difficult to take completely out of the judicial lexicon. Is it the better, more safe practice? One could argue certainly it is. Is it one that makes reversible error every time that a judge happens to use it, especially when giving a curative instruction, something that hasn't been priorly planned, when instructions that are written use it?
Do they use victim or alleged victim? And what instructions are you referring to?
I'm trying to think of the specifics of certain instructions.
Well, even if we take it away from the general run-of-the-mill case, in this case, where there's some suggestion that this trial judge has some personal link with the complaining witness or a complaining witness, does it exacerbate the situation?
I suggest under the circumstances it was used here, doesn't it? The complaint of time was once in relation to trying to form a curative instruction right after an objection, right on the spot. I suggest that there was no... of all the time through the trial, it's complained of one time. And in fact, it was such, it's used so often, even the defense attorney didn't object at the time. It wasn't until later on when he complained and said, well, Your Honor, when you made up that curative instruction on the fly as the judge was trying to do, used the term victim, and that's a problem.
And what were the circumstances that caused the curative instruction to be given?
At that time, it was an objection to the prosecutor's argument. Much as Mr. Gill started out here today with the government training rolling his entreaty to the jury to have courage to stop what he believed to be the unjust situation, the prosecutor in her rebuttal argument mentioned and went and took that theme and explained to the jury and began to make the statement, Mr. Gill has asked you to have courage. I ask that you have courage as well. Have courage to support two children. And then it was objected to part of what she was going to continue to say and take into account everything you've heard. The defense counsel objected, and the court ended up sustaining the objection and giving a curative instruction related to that statement. In it, the judge mentioned the word victim, or referred to the children as victims. And at that point, there was no objection to the way the curative was given. It was only later on that it was raised, and it was that single circumstance. I suggest that that point is not such that it certainly is reversible error. Yes, I would agree with the court that in those circumstances, using the term complaining witness might be better, or even alleged victim. But it is a trial judge trying to cure something happening in the middle of argument and using a term that is regularly used in trial. So I would suggest respectfully that also, which is argument three, doesn't warrant a reversal in this case. The reality is, the state suggests, when it comes to the recusal matter, and we've talked a great deal about it, mainly because that cast or attempts to cast a veil over the rest of the arguments made, is that this is a judge who just should have never been there. I suggest respectfully that when you take a look at this court's jurisprudence on recusal, that there, first of all, clearly the judge indicated her and any belief that this tenuous tie could break, could engender such sympathy that the judge could not sit impartially, simply isn't there.
Now, the predicate of, as I understand it, of Mr. Gill's argument regarding Marvin Dallas is that the view of the tape would have demonstrated to the trial judge that Marvin Dallas was involved in this case. But he has said, Mr. Gill has said, he hasn't seen the tape. He doesn't know what's in it. The state has the tape. How do we nail down whether Marvin Dallas is identified and that the judge therefore knew that for purposes of deciding this issue of recusal?
Well, I would assume that it is a court exhibit. I can't tell the court that I recall that right now, whether or not it is a court exhibit. Perhaps one of the ways it is to remand for inquiry of the trial judges to the specifics and whether that knowledge was had at the time or not. That would be the only probably practical way to do it, because the real question is what was in the judge's head at that time. Another possibility would be that the state could review the tape yet again and see and provide the court with any identifying information from that regarding Marvin. Is it just a name? Is it name and something else? But, you know, at this point, what we're going on is the fact that Mr. Gill believes, playing Columbo, that this must be the guy. But there's no evidence of that whatsoever.
Well, what if we assume that there is? Let's assume that videotape says Marvin Dallas, and we know that the judge saw that videotape before the trial began, I guess. So at that point, what's your position with respect to the recusal on an objective basis?
My position would be the same, that it isn't sufficient to believe objectively that this judge would have been disqualified from sitting in this case. We're talking about somebody who assaulted her former sister-in-law years ago, who was prosecuted for that case, and who now, at very least, this juvenile has suggested had also assaulted her or had sexually abused her. Again, from objective standard, if Marvin Dallas was the defendant, there might be a problem. The belief that engenders some great sympathy for these victims that colored anything the judge did, I suggest just is too tenuous to withstand Los Velos and the other cases this court has held regarding recusal. Is there any other questions?
I do have a question. Would you address the Rule 16 and the Brady argument, please?
Yes. The bottom line is this. There was a sustained examination done of the younger victim, T.S., and that was turned over in a timely manner in March of 2009. At the time, the state was unclear that, in fact, there was a sustained examination done of M.S., not related to this prosecution, not related to these complaints, related to the fact that she had had, she reported that, in fact, she had sexual contact with her foster brother. That was in February of 2009 that same examination was done. It wasn't done in relation to this. It ended up that there was some difficulty getting it. It was eventually obtained. The reality is this. To be a Brady violation, there has to be some exculpatory information in it. And to date, Mr. Gill still hasn't told us what that exculpatory information is, even though he sent it to expert witnesses. So, generally, it's either clear because it shows credibility or inconsistency or something else, or in these matters, generally, the physical findings aren't consistent with what you're telling us. To date, we still have not seen that. There is no evidence that these were exculpatory. As to the tape part of T.S.'s examination, it became clear when the nurse practitioner showed up at trial that, in fact, there was a tape done that sent, I see my red light, if I may.
Please, if you're still answering my question, continue.
I am. I'm trying to give the court the facts of that. There was a tape done to produce the same report. state did not know that, in fact, that was done by the same nurse. What they do is they tape it, and then they send it up to Dr. DeYoung up in Newcastle County, and he doesn't do the examination himself. As soon as that became clear, the state told defense counsel, who then objected to that same nurse testifying. So the bottom line in this ends up being that in order to either have a Brady violation or a Rule 16 violation, he has to show some prejudice. In Brady terms, it has to be exculpatory evidence which was withheld.
Or impeaching.
Or impeaching. And there's no evidence that it's either in this case. In fact, prior to trial, both sides said, we're not going to touch the same information because it doesn't help us one way or the other. It doesn't show that this did happen or did not happen. So both sides said, we're not going to touch it, we're not going to enter it, we're not going to use it at all. It was only an opening statement when Mr. Gilden said, well, they were examined by doctors, and they went to and was going to say, there's no evidence. That the whole issue then upheaved again, because now the question was the state going to have to bring these folks in to show, look, as we do many times, it's not positive evidence, it's not negative evidence. Sometimes these examinations just don't tell you one way or the other. So the state suggests that they're not exculpatory, they're not impeaching, and in fact, they were turned over as we could get them. The two things in particular were held by the doctor where they weren't even related, or the one MS wasn't even related to this investigation, and we still attempted to get it. The tape we did not know about until the witness was there, and then he objected to it, and he got what he should get under Rule 16. It was suppressed. The judge did not abuse her discretion in that ruling.
Okay. Thank you. You want to use your 23 seconds or waive it? It's up to you.
Never waste that. I appreciate the colonial reference. The Marvin Dallas situation is found out a whole lot easier by having a detective took a 5-minute phone call. The state's position on this case is at best willful ignorance. Call the detective, and Marvin Dallas is the same person from both particular cases.
And what is your basis for saying that?
A 5-minute phone call to the chief investigating officer after the case was over.
Okay. That's not in the record, but it's something that you did independently.
Correct. Which is something the state apparently can't do and chooses to gain. I really do wish, my time has expired, but I wish I could respond because the factual basis is completely wrong as to the answer to the Chief Justice's question about discovery issues.
Now, we'll consider the argument that set out in the briefs.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.
Please rise.